From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, John Kerry tells the Iraqi Prime Minister time is expiring to negotiate a political solution to the country's crisis.
The principal concern is for the Iraqi people, and ISIL is a threat to all of us.
But just how big a direct threat do the militants really pose to the West? Also today, Egypt's chilling and draconian jail sentences imposed on Al Jazeera journalists. We talked to one of them.
We were speechless, and there was pretty much silence. Everybody was just jaws on the floor.
The US sanctions Uganda over its anti-gay laws. We have a report from Kampala. And will man ever set foot on Mars? We'll have the latest on the development of the Orion rocket that could take him there. That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said that Washington's support for Iraqi security forces will be intense and sustained as they try to battle Sunni insurgents in the country who've now captured two key border posts. Mr. Kerry was speaking during a press conference in Baghdad after holding talks with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki about the crisis. From Washington, here's Lorna Shattuck.
Baghdad is John Kerry's third stop in a tour of Middle Eastern capitals as he calls on Iraq's allies to press the country's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, to govern in a more inclusive, less sectarian manner. After holding almost 2 hours of talks with Mr. al-Maliki, the US Secretary of State reiterated Washington's backing for Iraqi forces in their fight against ISIS militants. Washington hasn't publicly called for Mr. al-Maliki to step down, but has criticized him for alienating Iraq's Sunni minority and thus fueling the insurgency. At his press conference on Monday, Mr. Kerry also insisted that no country, the US included, has the right to pick Iraq's leaders. But he added that Mr. al-Maliki has reaffirmed his commitment to form a new government by the 1st of July.
Draconian, chilling, and a deeply disturbing setback to Egypt's transition. That's the U.S. State Department's description of the 7-year prison sentences handed down to 3 Al Jazeera journalists on Monday. It comes just 24 hours after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced he would be releasing more than $500 million in frozen military aid to the country. Now he's calling on President al-Sisi to review all sentences and verdicts pronounced during the last few years. Kate Fisher has more.
In a statement, John Kerry said injustices like these couldn't stand if Egypt was to move forward in the way that he says President al-Sisi told him just yesterday that he aspires his country to advance. Al Jazeera journalist Sue Turton, who was also sentenced today but in absentia, says she's devastated the US government has restored military aid while her colleagues are still in prison.
That is a huge blow. One of the bargaining chips that the West still had with Egypt has now gone and we have nothing to show for it.
John Kerry says he's calling on President al-Sisi to consider all available remedies, including pardons.
A Sudanese woman who was sentenced to death after marrying a Christian man is free from jail, according to her lawyer. Marianne Ibrahim faced the death penalty for abandoning Islam under Sharia law. She was pregnant at the time and gave birth in jail. Her husband, Daniel Wani, is an American citizen. He says he wants to get his family out of Sudan as soon as he can. International outcry put pressure on Sudanese authorities to overturn her sentence. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Syria has handed over the last of its declared chemical weapon materials for destruction. The announcement from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons marks a milestone in efforts to eliminate the country's stockpile, but does not come in time to meet a June 30th deadline for full destruction. Li Ling Tan reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
Syria's delivery of the last of its chemical weapons stockpile, as declared to the OPCW, brings the handover to 100%. The remaining 8% of Syria's declared toxic material, some 100 metric tons, have been loaded onto a Danish ship and will be destroyed at sea, said the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog. The latest handover, which completes the removal of some 1,300 tons of chemical weapons declared, was delayed due to rebel fighting, according to the Syrian government. That, along with other other delays mean that the June 30th deadline for the complete destruction of Syria's declared chemical weapons stockpile will not be reached. The OPCW said it is also looking into the alleged use of chlorine gas in Syria's civil war.
The Football or Soccer Association of Ghana has called in police following an undercover investigation by the British newspaper The Telegraph and the UK broadcaster Channel 4. The investigation found that the head of Ghana's Football Association agreed for the national team to play in international matches that were set to be rigged. UK correspondent Natalie Feary has this report.
The six-month-long investigation was launched after information was received showing some football associations were dealing with criminal gangs looking to fix scores of international games. Reporters posed as representatives from a company that wanted to sponsor games. The head of Ghana's Football Association said Ghana would play in rigged matches in exchange for $170,000 per match. Ghana's Football Association has said it will be seeking strong sanctions if the claims are true.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The principal concern is for the Iraqi people, for the integrity of the country, its borders, for its sovereignty. And ISIL is a threat to all of us.
Secretary of State John Kerry in Baghdad today at a meeting with the country's beleaguered Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He vowed intense and sustained support for the country's politicians, even as the US sends 300 military advisers to Iraq to offer fresh training and assistance to the country's armed forces.
We have two tracks, as you know. One is the security situation and the other is the political situation. And we need to work them in parallel.
There was an awkwardness to today's meeting with Prime Minister Maliki. US officials have scarcely concealed their view that he may not have much of a shelf life left, despite the fact that he was only recently re-elected. In Iraq today, rebels with ISIS, or as they're also known, ISIL, were consolidating their weekend gains in the north and west of the country. And here in Washington, President Obama, for the first time, described the threat that he says the group poses to the United States. He spoke on CBS.
Their extreme ideology poses a medium and long-term threat. There are a lot of groups out there that probably have more advanced immediate plans directed against the United States that we have to be on constant guard for. The thing about an organization like this is that typically when they control territory, because they're so violent, because they're so extreme, over time, the local populations reject them. We've seen that time and time again. We saw it during the Iraq War in places like Anbar province, where Sunni tribes suddenly turned against them because of their extreme ideology. We're going to have to be vigilant generally.
President Obama echoing the view of British Prime Minister David Cameron, who told lawmakers in London last week that ISIS has plans to attack Britain. So is the president correct in his description of the potential of ISIS militants to hit at Western interests? Dr. David Lowe teaches terrorism at Liverpool John Moores University.
In a sense he is, yes, because you look at groups like ISIS and they're not, for example, totally Syrian citizens or Iraqi mercenaries, and we, you know, it has been reported there are UK citizens there, no doubt there'll be some US citizens there. It poses a threat, on two fronts. One is this destabilization, and we can basically draw across from Northern Africa, right across from Somalia up towards Syria. It's such a destabilized region at the moment that there is a threat there. And then, of course, there are those individuals who will return to their home countries who can also pose a threat. So you could have it on two fronts.
Plenty of focus here, as you say, meanwhile, on British jihadists, those heading for Syria and Iraq, who will also, no doubt, many of them be coming back, appearing in recruitment videos, as we saw over the weekend. Does that amount for us to a huge failing on the part of our security forces that we still don't have a grip on the militant imams and mullahs?
No, I wouldn't say no, you know, that it would, because the problem we've had in this country is identifying individuals. Say, for example, with Ireland, it was a lot easier during that conflict to know who was a potential threat. In the UK and even throughout Europe, it is difficult to identify individuals who can be radicalised. With an awful lot of work has been done over the last 10 years to eliminate radical imams from mosques, and that's from the community themselves, because as part of the contest policy from the government, which where the prevent strand is about preventing radicalisation, there is the channel programme, and in the channel programme, part of it is the community themselves being involved in helping to identify individuals who could be radicalised or who have been radicalised, and to take a multi-agency approach in helping that individual. And what's interesting is, while this programme's been going for a number of years, is Syria, with just Syria alone, never mind Iraq, and I suppose we'll add Iraq to it now, the government has been looking at drawing up and implementing a similar plan to the channel programme for those returning from Syria and Iraq to try and help them. So I think it'd be harsh to say it was a failure. It is a constant ongoing problem that has to continually be monitored.
Dr. David Lowe of Liverpool John Moores University talking there to Lisa Aziz of Britain's LBC Radio. As you heard there, many questions are being asked in Britain and elsewhere about how young people from towns and cities across the Western world have found themselves fighting alongside ISIS in Iraq. Several of them, as we reported on Friday's programme, have appeared in new ISIS recruitment videos to the shock of their parents. The mother of one of the young men featured on the tape says she believes her son was brainwashed.
I don't know who it is, because I don't know. There's someone behind them teaching these young, innocent boys, brainwashing them to think they're going to help people. Someone behind them, we don't know who.
Her son, 20-year-old Riyad Khan, was from the Welsh city of Cardiff, where another of the ISIS recruits was also living and studying to be a doctor. In Cardiff, a city trying to understand how it's losing young people to ISIS, reporter Paul Barber.
Three young men from this city now, 20-year-old Nasser Mitana, his 17-year-old brother Esteel, as we heard from there, the mother of Riyad Khan, 20. Well, all of them, by various family and friends heard over the weekend, described as normal boys, all good in school. In fact, the Mitana's father speaking to reporters, saying that he fears for his sons being such good boys and saying they must have been brainwashed in the UK. The same goes for Riyad Khan's mother, sounding so distraught there. In fact, going on to say she was just shocked to see how much his character had changed from what she knew of him. We've been hearing from the mosque where the Mitana brothers prayed. It's called the Almana Center here in the city. And the trustee, Barak Albaiti, said he's sure attending that mosque wouldn't have been the source of the pair's radicalization. That's the two brothers. He thinks it's got to be down to the internet, claiming it's not just here in Cardiff, it's all over the UK.
Reporter Paul Barber in the Welsh city of Cardiff, now a recruitment ground for the forces of ISIS. This is FSN Reports.
7 years for Peter Grest, a repent behoos, and five other six defendants present. My God.
Oh.
My God.
Oh,
sorry.
That's crazy.
Finish.
That's crazy.
The parents of Al Jazeera correspondent Peter Grester learning today that he will spend the next 7 years in an Egyptian jail after being convicted alongside two of his Al Jazeera colleagues of supporting the now banned Muslim Brotherhood. The sentences were passed today in Cairo after a trial that most credible observers have dismissed as a sham. Secretary of State John Kerry, who only yesterday told the country's president and former army chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi that he's unfreezing $500 million in US aid, today called the sentences chilling and draconian and said they were a deeply disturbing setback to Egypt's transition. He urged the Egyptian government to consider all available remedies, including pardons for all the country's political prisoners. Also sentenced today in absentia, 11 defendants who received 10-year sentences. They include Al Jazeera correspondent Sue Turton, and she spoke to FSN's Kate Fisher.
We were speechless, and there was pretty much silence. Everybody was just jaws on the floor. Whereas for people listening, these are just names. For us, these are guys we've worked with. I mean, Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed, I have spent months with. Peter Grester is an award-winning correspondent, and I think everybody here was just gutted. Totally gutted to hear that not only were they not getting out, but they were giving these long sentences. I think we had really trusted in the Egyptian justice system, that because there had been no sense of evidence against us over the past months, and we just thought, with the world watching so carefully what happened in this court case, there's no way the Egyptian judge could say we were guilty.
This comes just 24 hours after the US essentially renewed its relations with Egypt, offering to restore millions and millions of dollars of military aid. John Kerry in Cairo meeting the new president. It's got to be quite hard to take that just 24 hours later this has happened.
Yeah, I mean, a few weeks ago I was in DC and I was in the State Department talking to some very senior people there, and they were being very supportive. And they were basically saying, you know, we recognise that Egypt has to demonstrate they are on the way to democracy. And I got real assurances that they would be bringing the situation with Gaza. I have to say, when I heard that the US government had agreed to release that money, I probably naively thought behind the scenes they'd got an assurance of some description that, you know, our guys were on the way out. That is a huge blow. One of the bargaining chips that the West still had with Egypt has now gone, and we have nothing to show for it. What really do we have left to bargain with? The only thing I can suggest is the tourism industry in Egypt is flatlining. And if people have a conscience, they will look at Egypt and think, well, we don't want to go and visit a country that treats journalists like that, that doesn't recognise freedom of expression, freedom of the press.
And do you think there, other than that kind of pressure, do you think there is any other avenue that you or Al Jazeera or the families of these men can take?
We will keep going. We will try and keep putting the pressure on Egypt. We will carry on with our media campaign. If Egypt thinks we're going to look away for a second, if Egypt thinks we're going to just think, well, our guys can rot in jail now, then they are seriously mistaken. There is the possibility of an appeal, although that does mean that we'll recognise we believe that the Egyptian justice system can be fair and balanced if we're going to go for an appeal. There's a chance that maybe the president might consider a pardon against us. But I just hope that they recognise in Egypt that it's not just doing an enormous amount of damage to our guys in prison, and it really is doing an enormous amount of damage, but it's doing an enormous amount of damage to Egypt's reputation and image.
And finally, Sue, what do you know of how your colleagues are coping, how they're doing in the terrible conditions that they're in?
We know they walked into court looking happy, looking confident, looking like they believed that that was the day they were going to be released. And we know the reaction in that dreadful cage that they're kept in the courtroom, the reaction was of devastation. I can only imagine now they're back in their tiny prison cell. It's 4 metres by 3 metres. There's three of them held together for 23 hours a day. I can't imagine how they're managing to lift their spirits. They must be just at the lowest ebb that they've been since this whole process began, because they were given false hope, to be honest. Abdullah al-Shami, our correspondent from Al Jazeera Arabic, who'd been on hunger strike, was released last week. And we really thought the tide had turned when that happened. And I'm sure they did. I'm sure that they believed that because one Al Jazeera reporter had been released, and this was Egypt recognising we're journalists just doing our job. The crushing blow that they must have felt in that cage, it just doesn't bear thinking about.
Sue Turton of Al Jazeera talking there to FSN's Kate Fisher. She was on the line from Doha. Next today to Uganda, where the government has described as unfortunate a move by the US to implement sanctions in face of the country's laws on homosexuality. The US is imposing visa bans on Ugandan officials who drafted the legislation that imposes tough new penalties for homosexuality. It also says it won't participate in a scheduled joint aviation exercise that was due to take place in Uganda, and will withdraw US assistance for some Ugandan government departments, including the police and the Department of Health. With Uganda's reaction, Michael Baleke reports from FSN's bureau in Kampala.
Uganda has started feeling the international backlash of enacting its anti-gay law. Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa says cutting funding will harm its most vulnerable people.
Well, I think the step taken is regrettable, but we have more areas in which we have cooperation with the United States, and these remain in place, and we think that our differences will be sorted out.
Cuts to programs target the Ugandan police and the health ministry, and the U.S. is also cancelling a U.S. military aviation exercise in Uganda. Sanctions targeting anyone involved in drafting anti-gay laws ban them from entering the U.S., a move that human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio says Uganda can't ignore.
Would health service providers become criminal liable merely for providing health services to people who are homosexuals? Those are questions we must address. Would lawyers, for example, providing legal services, counselors who are counseling, landlords who are providing houses for accommodation, for organizations and individuals that work on issues of LGBTI, be considered to be promoting homosexuality? These are issues we must address.
Uganda passed a law in February that strengthened criminal penalties for gay sex and made life sentences possible for those convicted of breaking the law. While Uganda is under international pressure over its anti-gay stance, human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio says it's facing domestic calls to revoke the legislation as well.
So this rhetoric about Uganda not caring is, in my own view, really simple posturing. We depend on donor money for survival. We need donor money to keep running basic services in this country.
The Obama administration is yet to identify the individuals barred from the U.S. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni insists his administration can do without foreign aid. I'm Michael Baleke in Kampala.
Well, the Obama administration has been at pains to say the sanctions it's implementing against Uganda would have been imposed against any country anywhere in the world that passed the kind of anti-gay laws now on the statute books in Kampala. That's a reflection of the fact that some in Africa are accusing the US of acting in a neo-colonial fashion, paternalistically wagging its finger at Kampala over laws that were democratically promulgated. Dr. Paula Gerber is an associate professor in human rights law at Monash University in the Australian city of Melbourne. And she says she thinks the West has to tread carefully, no matter how offended developed societies are by the Ugandan laws.
Probably the biggest worry is coming from mob attacks, that having laws like this on the book sends a message to the general populace, and particularly to sort of thugs and criminals, that it's okay to attack, to beat up, to even kill gay people. So the level of violence against the LGBTI community has gone up considerably. The laws themselves say that it is a crime to be committing consensual homosexual conduct, but that was already the case before this law. What this law, new law, has done, the Anti-Homosexuality Act has done, is to actually increase the degree of penalties and to create new offences such as aggravated homosexuality, which is repeated homosexual conduct, and also homosexual conduct between people who are HIV positive. And they've also created the offence of supporting gay people. So that could include, as I mentioned earlier, landlords renting premises to gays. But most worryingly, it also covers the medical profession. So if they treat someone who they know to be gay, for example, an HIV-positive gay man, then they themselves could be arrested and charged. I'm a bit troubled by sanctions. On the one hand, if it's economic sanctions, then that tends to actually harm the people the most, not the ones who are ultimately responsible for these laws. Sanctions that impose travel bans on the politicians who are directly responsible for these laws could have some positive impact, but I think it's unlikely. And I think the West has to be very careful when it is responding to these developments in countries like Uganda, because we don't want to be seen as neo-colonialists who now come in and say, you know, you cannot do this. I mean, Obama came out when the president had just flagged that he was considering signing the bill. Barack Obama came out and said, don't do that, that will complicate relations with the US. Well, the very next day the bill was signed. Why? Because it was perceived as bullying behaviour. It was perceived as the West telling Ugandans what to do. And that's never going to achieve a good outcome. So I think we need to have more sophisticated, more nuanced, more constructive responses to the developments, and also more consistent responses. Because although the Ugandan laws are highly objectionable and violate human rights, they are by no means the only country that has these laws on the books. And in fact, there are five soon to be 6 countries where the death penalty is imposed for homosexual conduct. That at least is not on the books in Uganda at this stage.
Dr. Paula Gerber of Monash University in the Australian city of Melbourne. Finally tonight, we take you out of this world. The NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden is expressing confidence that the space agency will succeed in putting humans on Mars. He was speaking after viewing the Orion spacecraft being assembled in Florida. Its aim is to carry astronauts into deep space. But a congressional report from the National Research Council this month blasted NASA for lacking a viable strategy for meeting that goal. FSN's Steve Mort reports from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
In a large hangar, NASA's most ambitious manned spaceflight project to date is taking shape. The Orion spacecraft is being assembled here in a clean room. The U.S. Space Agency says this is the module that will, if all goes well, eventually carry astronauts to an asteroid and even onto Mars.
Behind me is a tangible piece of our path to Mars, an Orion spacecraft that's going to travel farther into space than humans have gone for 40 years.
NASA's Administrator Charlie Bolden was at the Kennedy Space Center this week to see the spacecraft. Orion scheduled to blast off on an unmanned test mission in December.
While Orion hardware has been tested extensively on the ground, putting the spacecraft through its paces in space provides data you just can't get here on Earth. Right now, NASA's building on knowledge gained through the International Space Station and more than 50 years of human spaceflight experience, solving difficult challenges that will enable humans to safely explore deep space. What you see here today is a critical part of that strategic work.
But solving those challenges is not going well, at least according to a report out this month. The National Research Council, in an investigation ordered by Congress, predicts NASA's current strategy will fail to put humans on Mars, a lofty goal outlined by President Obama. The report calls into question the safety and sustainability of the project, but NASA is at pains to portray the U.S. as still being the leader in space. Mark Geyer is the Orion program manager.
This spacecraft, of course, is the first human exploration spacecraft developed in now over 30 years. It's a big deal, and it's the product of a very dedicated workforce that believes that keeping America first in space exploration is critical.
For those workers here at the Kennedy Space Center, the short-term mission is substantially more practical.
You know, we're going to be finishing up this vehicle here in the next month.
Cleon Lacefield is from Lockheed Martin and part of the team working on Orion.
We will be through with all of the functional tests, and we will then fuel it and then stack it onto the Delta IV heavy vehicle.
Orion is the main focus at the Kennedy Space Center, where the loss of the space shuttle program 3 years ago hit hard.
We're turning the corner now. It's a transition period, which are never easy.
Rex Walheim is a NASA astronaut who flew on 3 missions.
It's been 3 years since we launched on the last space shuttle mission, and now we're kind of turning the corner with both commercial crew to the space station and with the Orion program, so it's going to help a lot. And seeing this thing lift off and flying to space is going to be an amazing milestone.
Orion's test launch will be in December, when it'll travel 3,600 miles into space and then return to Earth at 20,000 miles per hour for a splashdown landing off the coast of California. Steve Moore to the Kennedy Space Center.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports, and the last edition that I'll be hosting for a bit. Kevin McAleese will be back in the anchor chair tomorrow after a 2-week vacation. Don't forget, you can always let us know what you think of the programme. You can send us an email at reports@featurestory.com, and you can interact with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks for everyone with FSN Everywhere. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow. Goodbye.